This week's show is sponsored by Firebind. Firebind keeps your ISP honest. If a good internet connection is critical to you or your customer's business operations, trust Firebind to give you the visibility you need to keep business on track. Check out their website at firebind.com for more details. Recording from Dell EMC World, our discussion today will be sorting out the C-level. What do those folks do in their corner offices, and how do we infrastructure make sense of the executive mind? I am your regular co-host, Ethan Banks. You can follow me at EC Banks, and this is the Datanauts podcast. Follow us at Datanauts Show and find all of our shows at packetpushers.net. Chris Wall is getting the week off. Joining me today is Keith Townsend. Keith, if you would, introduce yourself and tell the folks a little bit about your background.
Hi, I'm Keith Townsend. I'm at CTO Advisor on the Twitter. If you haven't heard from me before, I am a CTO Advisor. What does that mean exactly? I talk to that C-level suite or that senior architect, VP architect, helping to kind of make sense of this hybrid world that we live in. That's pretty much the world I live in and the people I interact with.
All right. You didn't start out as a CTO advisor, though, Keith. So I want to start out by just, what was your IT career? How did you start? Start at the beginning.
So I started out like most of us, believe it or not, IT help desk working the third shift. And like very much today, I started out the equivalent of searching for that. If you're on that VCP path, you know, I worked the third shift. I had found out about this certification called the MCSE. And I got a Windows 95, Mastering Windows 95 book, and I took that test. And months later, I had the MCSE, you know, a few months of experience and only an MCSE. But worked my way up from that help desk role into a server administrator, network administrator.
Dude, you were third shift help desk. That's like not a lot of calls coming in. You get
that. Exactly. I brought my BNC-based Windows 95, Windows 3.1 network from home, two PCs, and pounded out that. I just studied all night, man. It was a great, great opportunity.
Just curious, what kind of calls did you get with these drunk people?
You know what? It was traders. I supported a proprietary trading software. It was actually an interesting networking solution. They received real-time futures data over like that alternative bandwidth that cable providers had on the like channel. WGN had excess capacity, so it would be a one outside that third band. They received that futures data, and if they had trouble receiving data or whatever, mainly overseas people, so trying to explain what a tilde is from somebody from APJ is an interesting experience.
Okay, cool. So I'm right. You didn't get a ton of calls.
No.
And you had the opportunity to do your studying, and did you actually end up as an MCSE?
I did end up as an MCSE. I think about a year later when I took my first real enterprise job at the Chicago Tribune, of all places. A few months after taking that job, I got my MCSE.
Pretty news on dead trees.
It was a great company at one point when people bought newspapers.
Yeah. So what era of MCSE was this? Was this NT4 or 2000?
This was NT4. So this was the good stuff, man.
You and me both. Yeah. I did the same thing. Yeah. NT4, MCSE. I had a series of books and videos that me and a friend of mine, we went halvesies on. We bought this training kit. I don't remember if it was Microsoft Press or who put it out, but there were the six tests we had to go through. Internet Information Server was one. There was a networking one. There was, anyway, the one about the controllers and the PDCs and BDCs. And
yeah, it was like a bunch of them, like from Cybex and those guys. Yeah. Well, do you remember you had to get your network certification? You know, you have the big network, CNE or CNA, the big red book that
big
you always
books.
Have. Yeah, the big red books, man. Those things were awesome.
Yeah, I did a lot of the Novell stuff as well. In fact, I did Novell before I did MCSE.
You know, my job opportunity within Tribune to go to network administrator or server administrator was actually a Novell administrator. I'm like, what is this Novell stuff? And then I did Novell. I'm like, this stuff is way better than NT4.0. So it was when Windows 2000 came out, I was not a fan.
Oh, no?
No,
see,
no.
So what happened to me, it just didn't matter what I thought of it from a technology standpoint because Microsoft had come in the door. They were taking over the Office suite where it was you were buying Word and you were buying Excel, at least those two. And right. they started throwing Outlook in there for free. And you know what really works really well on the back end of Outlook is Exchange. So if you've got an Exchange server in Outlook, those are, and it's an amazing pairing. And you know what makes all that really good is if you've got a NT domain controller, and so that would be in there. Then all of a sudden it was kind of like, why do we have Novell anymore? Because they got file and print on Windows.
Yeah, they did file and print really well. You'd have to stop and start the spooler service on NT4.0, you know, every few hours.
Yeah.
But it eventually worked. You know, when it printed, it printed.
I did Novell GroupWise to NT4 Exchange 5.0, I suppose, 5.0 or 5.5 mailbox migrations. I had to do the migration. It was a 600-person shop. I would pick, you know, today's your day. You know, I'm doing 20 mailboxes today. And there were, you know, after we had this whole sheet of before your mail was this. Now your mail is going to be this. And we're going to take all your mail from the old and put it into the new. And there was this tool I had to run. And
yeah, we were stubborn. We were doing NDS on NT4.0. We were just very stubborn. And then Active Directory 2000 came out and we're like, this stuff is not really good. But Microsoft got it together, and yeah. like you said, the products that you used all worked well together, and for whatever reason, we used to call it the CIO got golden golf clubs from Microsoft, because when we next day we came in, everything was Microsoft. Everything, the whole migration plan was to Microsoft.
Between Novell's bad marketing and Microsoft's just the inevitability of it and the fact that it really did work all together and made for a seamless system, it was just a juggernaut. You couldn't get away from it.
Yeah. How many people ran Small Business Server 2000 forever?
What a horrible product.
It was a horrible product, but they ran it forever.
Yeah. Yeah, boy. Okay. So we're still 15 years in the past or so. What happened next for you?
So after that, I went, the thing about the MCSC, when you don't know a lot, you're surprised at how much you don't know when you find out you don't know it. Like any other certification, you know, someone's going out and getting their CCNA for the first time, their VCP, they're like, oh, man, I know so much about technology that I can go out and do anything. I thought I could go out and consult. I'm like, okay, I can make $100 an hour maybe by now. Okay, I have 3 years in experience. I can make $100 an hour. I did initially because it was Windows 3.1 to 95 days and people were doing Y2K migrations and remediation. So I mucked around and did a little bit of contract work for a year. Then I had to take a step back and go back into a network and systems administrator role, which actually taught me a lot because I was in a really nice size SMB that had a lot of resources, but not a lot of money for OpEx. So I ran a lot of projects like rolling out checkpoint firewalls, upgrading to Windows XP migration, just a wide range of infrastructure projects that got me a lot of exposure and set the kind of base of where my technology focus is today, which is just all around.
My path was a little different in that I ended up getting pretty siloed into the networking stuff. You know, right around that time from you were talking about where it was that that transition into a lot of Microsoft. Novell was fading away. I had the Cisco Frame Relay deployment project handed to me. And I didn't know anything about anything. I was scared, but I had all these routers to deploy for this energy company, and they were just giving me a router and saying, you're going to plug this in and you're going to type these commands and everything's going to be good. And I was like, then I was like, okay, I got that project done. It was okay. I had some support people to fall back on. Then I was like, I got to study. So I ended up getting my CCNA, and then I never looked back. I just loved it.
Right.
And so I ended up getting very silent, but the server stuff that I had done for all those years prior never went away. And there was always Linux was in there, and I did some web hosting for a small ISP for a while, and all of that knowledge kind of dovetails in. And it seems like today we're just in a world where rather than, yeah, everybody still operates in silos, but it's slowly but surely coming all back together.
Yes, it definitely is. I would always find myself in an envious position where I look at people in silos, and I say, man, I would really love to know enough to be a CCNP or a CCIE, or I really love to know enough to be a deep MCSE, or server virtualization finally came out. I'm like, man, I'd love to go past the VCP route and just really be an expert in the model. But you know what? Again, silo experts have their place. And most definitely that person who knows a lot about, or a little bit about a lot, obviously has a place in today's market.
It's a weird little story. Troubleshooting a system down, cannot process kind of an issue on a team of just everybody who was the leader or the architect in their group, heads together on the conference call, the fact that I knew something about web certificates, I was able to raise a question on the call, even though I was the networking person, the load balancer person. That's why I was on the call and said, wait a minute, this sounds like we're having a certificate negotiation issue. Is there a cipher problem? Is something changed in that world? And all of a sudden a light went on in one of the other guys' heads and he goes, oh, we did an upgrade for this and I forgot it said in the release notes something about the cipher negotiations had changed. And just having that knowledge was incredibly valuable. And so just to your point, knowing a little about a lot in IT is great. Yeah, maybe you want to know a lot about something specific, but a little about a lot is really helpful. So social media, Keith, how did you get involved in were you a blogger, tweeter? How did social media come about for you?
So it actually came about via blogging, I think in 2010, when a lot of us was going through a rough job market. I had been laid off. I had always had in the back of my mind that I'd start a blog. I had nothing but time because the job market was absolutely dead. So I started a blog. And then the blog, through either comments or I can't remember if it was comments or LinkedIn, Twitter kind of came up in the conversation. I had already joined Twitter. It just exploded from there.
And what kind of things were you blogging about?
So back then, it was mainly virtualization. You know, my handle, if some of you guys remember me from those days, my handle was Virtualized Geek. I had gone knee-deep into VMware virtualization. So a lot of the topics was on home labs, nesting, networking inside of ESXi, a lot of really deep technical content around VMware and VMware vSphere.
And now you're doing CTO Advisor. So how did you make that leap?
So interesting. Around that same time, I had just finished off my undergrad in computer science. So I got my undergrad as an adult. That took me to Lockheed Martin as a architect. Great job. I got to use a lot of that knee-deep skill in a bunch of different areas. And one of the things I didn't realize about the architect role is that you do a lot of project management. And you do a lot of project management work. So you end up...
I'm laughing. I'm nodding my head. Yes.
End up leading a lot of projects. And that, as I was thinking about what to do next as far as education, I decided to get my master's in IT project management. And that led to an opportunity for me to go to PwC as a management consultant. So the bleeding over of technology plus my newly acquired management plus business skill kind of appealed to a PwC. So I more or less stepped away from technology and spent 2 years at PwC where almost every day was no longer specifically solving technology problems, but solving business problems.
With all that technology as the backdrop. In other words, you still couldn't have done that job without all of those years in tech.
Yeah, exactly. So one example of a project that was related to technology was that a big credit card processor had gotten breached. They were on the cusp of basically going out of business. So a Fortune 500 was going to go out of business if they didn't pass their next PCI audit. So we got in there and we helped them change their IT processes, business processes to pass their audit. And they, you know, everybody wins at the end. The firm got, you know, millions of dollars in consulting fees and the company got to stay in business.
And so now you're not at PwC, I don't think, are you?
No. You know what? The interesting thing about that role is that your number one tool in PwC as a technologist. So if you have all of this technology background and you're relatively good at management and business, your number one tool becomes Excel pivot tables and PowerPoint. So I tell the story all the time. Instead of 11 guys in a conference call or in a data center trying to figure out how to bring the network back up, you have 11 guys on the phone trying to find the right color blue for the presentation the next day. And it just wasn't the way I wanted to spend the next 15 years of my career.
And so you just kind of decided, I'm taking a risk. I'm doing this. I'm going independent.
No. So that was part of the risk. The other part of the risk was, okay, now who am I? I'm no longer a deep technologist. I was quite embarrassed the other night. We were doing a V Brown bag on building a home lab. And someone said, hey, Keith, go to the data store tab and show me the specifics of this data store on your vSphere home lab. And I said, you know what? Tell me what buttons to push because I don't know.
You step away from it for years.
Logically, I know how this stuff is, but what value do I have to offer? I'm not really a CIO. and I'm not a engineer or pure architect anymore, what do I have to offer? And figuring that out took me a little bit of time to say, you know what? I'm no longer a virtualized geek, and I'm not a CIO advisor, and that CTO advisor path kind of fell right in my lap.
The thing that really stuck out to me from Keith's journey was the importance of education. So as we listened to what Keith was saying along his career, he studied and got his MCSE, and he did some Novell training. And then he did some college level work as well right along the way. And that education is what kept him early on in the specific technical knowledge required to be very capable at his engineering job. And then later, which we'll hear more about later in the show, enabled him to do a somewhat different career move and head off into a different direction when he wanted to do that. So education is a very big deal. Our sponsor today is Firebind, and I want to talk about this product a little bit. This is a network monitoring tool that helps you determine exactly where things are broken along the network so that you can point the finger in the right place and get that problem resolved as quickly as possible. For example, you can continuously monitor your ISP connection, slash your network outages and slowdowns when that happens, because Firebind is going to tell you exactly what's going on and where. Detailed visibility you get out of this product so you can more quickly tackle these issues. By the way, this isn't just for enterprises, although enterprises is certainly one of the key targets here for Firebind, but also, let's say you're a vendor, you're a SaaS provider selling your own services out there, and you need the service of your connection to be really solid. Excellent. Firebind can help you so that when your customer's complaining about poor performance, you can look to your Firebind and go, aha, I see exactly where the problem is, and then go and get that resolved. Three key features of Firebind here. You can rapidly configure and deploy the agents just in a few minutes to pretty much any system, Linux, PC, Mac, virtual private server, if you like, even Raspberry Pi is a form factor that's supported. Another key feature here, agents that simulate user activity by performing 11 different tests every 5 minutes. So you get tests for packet loss, latency, jitter, HTTP, and then DNS response time. Again, all the things that you're going to need to set up and transactions that you're going to need to understand to truly understand the performance of your app over a network. And then you can configure custom alarm thresholds per agent and then get notified automatically when the network quality degrades, which is a bit proactive. You know, when things start to go south, Firebind lets you know, hey, things are heading south before things blow up and get really bad and you're reacting to a bad problem. You kind of know something's going on. And you would tweak those thresholds to exactly what your application needs that you're monitoring to know what's going on. So visit firebind.com, request a free trial. And if you mention the Packet Pushers podcast, get a free month of service. So again, firebind.com and mention the Packet Pushers. Packet Pushers is the host for this fine Datanauts podcast. And if you mention them, you will get a free month of Firebind service. One more time, that's firebind.com. So, Keith, I want to spend the rest of the show picking your brain about what you've learned about the C-suite, the C-level, those guys and girls in the corner office, how they think, what their roles are, what their concerns are. So I'll set the background this way. For me, my IT career was very typically down in the trenches, down in the working on operations, maybe at an architecture level, you know, almost certainly at an engineering level, depending on which role I had where. I was very rarely in management. I dealt with managers and so on, and it was their boss or their boss's boss, 2-3 levels above me maybe, that would have been C-levels, those chief whatever.
Right.
I didn't interact with those folks, and a lot of times some of the things that would come down from those offices or my boss would be in one of those meetings with those folks and would say, okay, here's our new marching orders, would seem a little insane or a little like they have no idea what we're dealing with down here. We can't deal with this right now, or et cetera. There was definitely a disconnect between what was happening in the trenches and what was happening in the commandant's office, if you want to look at it that way, if I'm going to carry a military metaphor. So I thought maybe we could walk through what some of the, I just picked out some C-level titles that I'm familiar with, and maybe you could share with us what your take is on what their roles are, so that those of us in the trenches maybe have a better perspective on the corner office, starting with the CEO.
The CEO, depending on the organization, can be anywhere from the face of the company to the leader of the company to the manager of the company, depending on what the board of directors initially need in their current CEO. There's wide-ranging examples. Michael Dell is probably one of those ones that's a hybrid. He is most definitely the face of Dell, for example, Dell EMC. And he's also, I think, their leader.
Like a visionary?
Yeah, like a visionary. He kind of looks at the overall market, understands where it's going, understands what products to prioritize and what strategies are the right ones for the entire organization, sets those marketing orders, and then has his staff, his direct reports, execute upon that.
So, but he's looking at the business, the CEO as a whole. He understands, again, the market, how that business fits into the market, and is, again, that vision to see where the business should be today and then where the business should be tomorrow.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay. But as far as specific engineering and technical skills, maybe, maybe not.
Yeah. Again, Michael Dell would be the exception. Michael Dell and even the Pat Gelsinger, who have engineering backgrounds, there are exceptions to the rule. Most CEOs will come from either the sales or operations organization, and they will have a different view than the actual in a technology company, or you work for a technology portion of a company. They won't necessarily have a focus on technology.
Okay, so let's move from the CEO to the CMO, which to my mind is Chief Marketing Officer. And I raised that one because they seem to have a big impact on IT.
Yeah, this is a relatively new role. It might have been a sales function before, but this has been called out as when you hear a lot about digital transformation. A lot of times the CMO, that chief marketing officer, is leading that digital transformation, helping their end users, whether it's a cigarette company sell cigarettes to kids in India or whatever your business is. It's this person's job to connect the organization's product with the overall market and make sure that that market is well served. And today, that means making sure digitally that the company can leverage its digital assets to its physical access.
Then the CIO, Chief Information Officer.
So this role is actually morphing. Before, this used to be a risk-based role, basically back office, making sure that the company's financial systems, HR systems, all of those back office systems are in proper working condition and that the costs are controlled. That role is now morphing into making sure that these assets can be leveraged by business groups such as the CMO.
Okay, so the assets. So we could be talking about physical assets that we own in the form of data centers, servers, and networks, and these sorts of things, software. But those assets could also now mean cloud, what I've got there.
So it can mean cloud. It can mean, and not just that, let's go back to what it is that they're helping to leverage. It's the actual information. So Chief Information Officer is actually the data itself and leveraging the data assets of the company. So it can be making sure we can mine the SAP or ERP data, take that data lake and mix it with the financial, some other financial data or market data, and make sure that infrastructure is available to be consumed in a way that the CMO or any other business group can leverage.
Well, you just cleared up something really key there. Chief Information Officer, and the accent on that word information, as opposed to Chief Infrastructure Officer.
Exactly.
Different thing. Yeah. So then CSO, again, I've seen this described different ways, but Chief Security Officer is what I'm getting at.
And again, in different organizations, that means different things. A lot of times the CISO or CSO position focuses on technology. So making sure the digital assets of a company is protected. And a lot of organizations, forward-thinking organizations, again, it's about making sure information is protected. So the role will sometimes sit inside of the CIO or IT organizations. Sometimes it'll sit outside of it because it's not just digital information that needs to be protected, but intellectual property in general or even physical security. So in some organizations, that CSO role is anything security related when it comes to either physical, personal, or data security, this person is in charge of.
To close out the list of C-levels that I want to talk about, CTO, Chief Technology Officer.
And again, this depends on the type of organization that you're in. In a traditional enterprise, this is relatively a new position or sometimes doesn't exist at all. There can be some overlap with the CIO. A CTO is basically the audience that I speak to. You can think of this more of the architect, the ultimate technology architect of an enterprise. And a vendor, that may be a little bit different. This may be a customer-facing role where this is the face of the product to the customer, or that they're in charge of the product roadmap within a vendor. But when we're talking about the typical enterprise, this is the senior most architect within the organization.
And so if there were such thing as a chief infrastructure officer, maybe that would be this guy.
That would be this guy or one of his direct reports.
Okay. The under chief technology officer. This is how, this is the person in charge of how an organization is using technology.
Well, not just how they use technology. So it can bleed over. CIO can talk about how an organization uses technology, where the CTO talks about what technologies a organization will use and the standards about which they use those technologies.
All right. Who do these people answer to, the C-levels?
You know, other than the CMO, I think the CMO is the one that almost universally answers to the CEO. The CIO, CSO, CTO, those will be varying reporting lines. It could be to the CEO. Rarely is, unless you're in a really large organization, you'll get the CIO who reports directly to the CEO. The CIO, CSO, CTO may report into the CFO, the chief financial officer, or the COO, the chief operating officer. So all of those roles are usually looked upon as operating roles. And depending on how the organization is structured, you'll have those roles reporting to whoever runs operations.
The CEO himself or herself would report to who?
The CEO reports to the board of directors.
Okay. Everybody's got a boss.
Yeah, everyone has a boss. Everyone has someone to answer to.
How do these roles interact?
With the CIO, CSO, CTO, those can be peer roles, or the CSO and CTO might report to the CIO. So if they're peer roles, it's an interesting conflict or interesting set of interactions, as the CSO, CTO, and CIO don't always have the same agenda. I'll say they have the same objective, but they don't always have the same agenda. So those three roles can be peer roles, whereas the CMO and CEO are most definitely customers of the CIO, CSO, and CTO.
Different, right. I've seen this play out sometimes. You know, the different, maybe the same objectives, as you put it, but different agendas.
Exactly.
And I've seen politics kind of play out as a result of this. Sometimes there's more than, maybe they have some of the same objectives, but they also have some personal objectives, and maybe there's a little bit of a power struggle that can happen.
You know, it's at that level, you still have career objectives. Most of these guys still want to get to that COO level or the CEO level. So they want resume builders. They want to say that we have cloud. They want to say that, you know, we've enabled the business in this way, or we've saved X amount of dollars, or we've created X amount of dollars of opportunity. There's still goals that are, I think, overall good for the business, but not always, I think, complementary to the other business's goals.
Is it fair to say that most people listening to the show who are going to be infrastructure engineers of some stripe, if you looked at their report chain, eventually they'd end up at the CTO? Is that?
Yeah, so eventually most of, unless we're in an architecture role, most of us will report up to the CIO eventually. And the CTO organization is usually not that big. In some organizations, it's actually an individual contributor role.
Okay. Off to the side, kind of informing what's going on, but maybe not, you know, with hands into the day-to-day ops as much. Okay.
Correct.
Well, let's focus on the CTO role a little bit more. Who does this person answer to?
So again, sometimes the CIO, sometimes the CFO or COO, this role was created because the organization probably lacked, or they had the vision to say that outside of CIO, the person who operates the business, we need somebody with vision. So similar to that visionary CEO that we'll go out and hire, he may not be an operations guy, but he's a great thinker. I wouldn't necessarily put him in charge of an organization, but if I need somebody who can figure out a tough problem, the CTO is that guy, and we'll just let, you know, him and his weird science experiments leave, and he has some deliverable to deliver something, a technology into the CIO's organization.
And then from an operations perspective, the ops folks are going to answer back to that CIO.
Correct.
But the vision and the architectural leadership would come out of the CTO and the CTO's
exactly.
office.
So depending on the size of the organization, he might have a ton of architects working for him, or maybe a couple of engineers, but these are all going to more or less be high-level thinkers normally. These are not going to be people that keyboard unless they're creating differentiating products. So product creation within some organizations like Walmart. So Walmart's CTO will most definitely have a team of programmers, and all of the product development may be under CTO. And when I say product, I mean internal applications might be on the CTO. And then they moved that into operations under the CIO's business unit.
You mentioned CTO as being a visionary role, an architectural role, someone who's going to understand a problem and come up with a solution, a technology solution that can address that problem. Aside from that problem solving, that analytical capability, what else is going to weigh heavily on their minds?
Business. The bottom line, this person has to understand the business. At Dell World today, we did several keynotes or several messages within the keynotes where Dell talked about the speeds and feeds of its products. You know, the VxRail, VxRack, and all of the different data domain products that are available. The CTO needs to understand how to apply that to solving business challenges. So when they're interacting with the CMO or when they're interacting with the sales organization or the manufacturing organization, they need to be able to identify the problem and understand how technology specifically solves that problem. That is going to be a huge part of their thought process. And then overall, how do they integrate the overall operations into the new technologies that they're implementing? So they can't just create a product or vision and throw it over to the CIO's group to implement. They need to understand how that's going to impact current IT operations and current business.
In other words, they can't just say, this is so cool, we got to do this. They've actually got to be able to make it real.
Yeah, it's not just a sandbox.
My vision of the CTO is a little different than what reality was. I kind of thought the CTO was the person in charge of all the technology. And what Keith helped me understand here is that the CTO role is really a visionary one. It's an architectural one. The business has some really interesting problems to solve. And how are we going to use technology to solve those problems? And it's the CTO and those people that are answer to the CTO that are going to figure that out. Well, if we apply this new technology in this way, that helps us solve the business problem. And then we can compare it to this other way that we could also solve the problem, but has these advantages, but these disadvantages, etc. And then they end up with a decision point and then lay that new architecture down for the rest of the company, which would probably be handled by folks on the operations side, which would ultimately answer to the CIO as opposed to the CTO. So that was a really important clarification for me. Keith, I want to move the conversation ahead to takeaways for the technologists, those of us listening to the show that are down in the trenches. You know, we've been talking about these folks in this executive role. What are the things that maybe we could consider that are going to make us better at our job, maybe help us even indirectly interact with those folks better? Let's start with this. Actually, it's kind of a practical question. Are we too far down the ladder to even care?
No, I think it's common. So, Ethan, you have a lot of enterprise experience. You know, when review or goal time comes up, there's always goals that are pushed down, right? There's going to be either from some C level or some senior vice president level, you're going to have goals that you have no options on negotiating. Just this is the goal for the entire business unit, or this is the goal for the entire organization.
That could be getting product out the door. That could be, you know, a sales number. That could be shipping a product. Right. Something that comes down from on high.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's a reason for that. It's not just a political thing that those things are there. It's there so that everyone from a server administrator to a forklift operator understands the mission of the organization. And from the CEO on down, that mission, whatever those objectives are critical to understand. And that's on everyone's goal list. So it's important to understand what are the important drivers of your C-level that you report up to, all the way down through your senior management to your frontline management to your everyday employee.
In other words, it's important for no matter where you are, you need to understand the goals of the business.
Exactly.
Which is something that we've talked about on the show before, because it's not enough to be so mired down in, I don't know, it could be trouble tickets. It could be, you know, log entries that you're assessing about or, you know, trying to do a forensics on something, some security event. And you can get so bogged down in all those details that you can forget the business. The things that are important to you are the fact that you got some red light on a monitoring server because some server's underperforming or, you know, this network link is down and you're just obsessed with those details or getting the upgrade done or that you just don't see the business and the business objectives and you're irritated that your change control got rejected because of it's end of month. We got to close the books, you know, or it's end of quarter, end of year, even more.
Well, you know, something that a lot of people can relate to, if you've ever have to book corporate travel and it says the fare must be within X dollars of the lowest fare, and if not, you just can't book it. But we know the problem isn't as simple as selecting the cheapest fare, because it could be additional bookings for bags or the number of legs you have to take or the ability to connect in flights. We need to take that same mentality when we look at what the business is asking us to do. What's the end goal overall picture?
All right. So still, though, the people in the trenches tend to have their own perspective on what's going on in the business. And sometimes we get this urgent feeling that there's something people aren't understanding. They're asking us to do X, but if they understood these other things, maybe they wouldn't be asking us to do that. It's a little crazy. So when we have something really important that we feel strongly about, that we want to communicate to the C-suite, how do we do that?
There's a couple of different things that we need to do. One, we need to understand the C-suite's perspectives and objectives. This is why, again, understanding the objectives are important. And once we understand the objectives, we can then communicate upwards. This term, managing up, is a real term. A lot of times, C-suites, the message gets lost between the C-suite and when it hits us. I'll give you an example. I worked for, or I did some consulting for, a Fortune 50 technology company. From the highest level of the organization, the directive was, you must reduce depreciation by this much. Don't care how it happens, but depreciation must be decreased. When it gets down to kind of that engineer level, it's, hey, you know those 18 servers you provisioned last month? I need you to deprovision them. And you're like, wait, hold on. I worked really hard at that, and why are we just turning it off? I don't understand. And if we turn it off, there's a reason why we deployed them, and you're not understanding. I just can't turn them off. And it's understanding, it's communicating up and understanding what's the driver for turning off those 18 servers, and then offering, being prepared to offer an alternative and say, oh, you know what? These 22 servers that are even more expensive, we're really not using those, and they don't serve a critical business function. So we can get rid of those instead of getting rid of these 18 really important servers.
So when you got that message to deliver up, chain of command?
Chain of command normally. It's asking questions. Hey, Bob, why is it that we have to decommission these 18 servers? Can you help me understand? And this is something I push engineers to, and you should push your managers to, is how does deprovisioning 18 servers at the end of the day help our customers? And I don't mean our internal customers. I mean, if we sell widgets to school systems in Alabama, how does this help the kids? And if you do get pushback, you're probably working in the wrong organization. Within your organization, you're working for the wrong organization, period. If you get pushback when you talk about how does the activity that you question helps your end customer, you're going to get a response. Either the manager is going to stop and think about it, or they're going to be prepared to get, they've already thought about it, and they're going to give you an answer prepared to help you through that, or it sparks a conversation.
One thing I want to stress here is, from a chain of command perspective, is don't just be, I'm skipping my boss because I don't want to deal with that. I'm marching right into, you know, chief whoever's office and going to stomp my foot and, you know, raise hell. That's not
a good idea.
No.
No. I've been in those meetings and you will be labeled difficult. You could be right. You could be absolutely right. But if there's an art to communicating upwards, and that's not a great art.
And I think you could lose respect marching above your boss or even two levels above your boss and just, you know, to try to make yourself known. And probably physically not going to, you'd probably just send an email, you know, with your rage and ire documented there. But I think those folks at a higher level want you to follow chain of command as well.
Exactly. And most organizations have a open door policy. And there's a feel for it. You can actually skip your manager and have that conversation directly with your boss's boss. But it's the way that you approach it. It's not, hey, Larry told me to decommission these 18 servers. I don't agree with him. It can be, hey, Sue, can you help me understand our objectives for the year and how my job aligns to those objectives? I've had a conversation with Larry, but I think we're missing something in translation. And that's a very respectful way to not go over your boss's head, but go over your boss's head.
Being respectful and being reasonable, coming across as a reasonable person, goes so far. Like you said a minute ago, you don't want to be labeled as being difficult, which engineers, something about us, we tend to be very idealistic. Things are black and white, and this is the way they're supposed to work. And budgets? No, you buy the best thing because it's the best thing. We didn't have the money for that. I mean, I have to compromise? That sucks. You know,
run Hyper-V?
We got we just get this mindset of, you know, this absolute way that things must be and want to really enforce that. But that is not cool, because there's a human aspect to this, is the human element and respect and reasonableness and the way you phrase things and say things and the smile on your face and not hitting send after you've written the cathartic angry email, because then it's less cathartic if you actually hit send. You just want to write it and then delete it, you know, not actually put it out there.
It's okay to question why we do it, and it's okay to disagree with the eventual decision, but it's critical that we understand and respect the process that these people went through to make the decision. We don't have to agree with it at the end, but if we understand it, then it goes a long, long way for us being able to toe the company line when we don't necessarily agree with it.
Now, Keith, I've been in a bunch of situations where there's something critically down in the IT infrastructure. Things are bad. The business is impacted. Customers cannot process or whatever it is that's going on. It's bad. We're having a bad day. Sometimes the C-level folks show up when you're in the middle of that crisis. What is it they want to know?
They want to know when it's going to be back up. Plain and simple. So to relate the story from when this one organization's SAP was down for 3 days. And that's tens of millions of dollars in revenue over a three-day period. And it was very, very painful. At that point, C-level wants updates every hour. Even if they don't understand it, they want to know what's going on and basically what's the real prognosis and getting it back up and who's on it. Is it the best people? Is there anything they can move out the way to make sure that it's back up? Do they need to bring in vendors? Do they need to give the CEO, do they need to give Michael Dell a call? Because they have that power to call Michael Dell. They want to make sure that they're using their power to make sure they enable you. They're under pressure, and that pressure is going to roll down.
So they're under pressure, which makes engineering people feel under pressure as well. But it's not personal pressure or criticism exactly. It's more they're looking at it from a business perspective. The business is impacted. Their customers are impacted. It could be in the press, depending on what the situation is. It could be pretty ugly. So they're in a situation of great pressure themselves. It's not like they're just sitting there eating Cheetos in their office, you know, staring out the window, wondering
solitaire if their PC is up.
Wondering whether BMW isn't as shiny as they wish it was today. They've got real concerns.
Yeah, whether it's the board of directors calling them, investors calling them, the market calling in, you know, analysts calling in, customers. Let's say that you provide medicine and you have a very tight schedule and inventory, and there's people that need to take their insulin shot, and you're producing the insulin, and the piece of equipment that's down holds up production. Sometimes this can be life or death situations. So, and they are the face of the company. They get all of the accolades when it goes well, and they get all of the crap when it rolls downhill.
Yeah.
They're the start of it.
Is it fair to say that if one of these folks goes off during a crisis, they lose it, they're upset, it's not personal?
Yeah, so it's not personal, but I think one of the things, and I've had appreciation for this in the past when I've had managers that stepped in, is that a great manager, whether it's a director, senior manager, if you're the engineer with your hands on the keyboard, you're not getting that update to the CEO. That update is coming through the chain of command. This is where chain of command should work extremely well. The CEO should never be in the data center or calling you directly. It's your job to fix it. You need to be focused on fixing it. Us engineers, the fact that a mission critical system is down, we don't need to know what it does. We just know that there's a lot of pressure and we need to get this thing up. We're not going to sleep until we get it up. We're not going to work much harder. We're not going to become magically smarter because we find out that it's even more critical than we've known. It's for that upper layer of management to deal with that communications. And if you are in a situation where you get that C-level coming down to you directly, it's time for you to have that conversation with your manager that he's not being the servant that you need him to be in those situations.
I want to go back to the issue of respect, Keith. We talked about this a little earlier in the show. And I think for engineers and architects who've spent a lot of time at the keyboard, their prowess is how they identify their personal worth. If you're that girl that can absolutely knock a router config out of the park, and if that thing's down, you're the one they go to bring that thing back online, that is one of the things you're proud of. And if the same thing for a lot of engineers, it's very typical feeling. And so if you're working for someone who can't do that stuff, you kind of don't respect them maybe. think maybe this is a younger person's thing too, but certainly I've run into a lot of folks who deal with this. And you get up to the C-level stuff, and a lot of these folks are professional managers, if you will, kind of like some people are professional politicians. And you go, have they ever done any real work in their lives? Give us some perspective here. Why should we respect people that are in these positions, even if they don't have the engineering backgrounds?
You know what? I've been in the boardroom, and I've had to listen to some of the challenges that these people have to solve. And they are equally, if not more, tough than the challenges that we have to solve. If you ever read that book,
Phoenix Project?
Yeah, Phoenix Project. Awesome book, but it's all magical. You know,
yeah, it is a bit abstract.
When we think about what they did, the continuous integration that they did at near the end of the thing, you're like, with our mainframe, you're like, oh my God, that's logistically, that's just technically, that's hard.
It got a little hand wavy towards the end.
Yeah, like, oh, don't look at the man behind the curtain. Well, a lot of the decisions that these folks have to make are at that level. While we're arguing about whether or not we're going to use iSCSI, NFS, or Fibre Channel, they're trying to decide if they need to outsource the entire IT because they're under pressure to deliver some type of result, whether it's agility, capability, or cost savings. They need to be able to assess something that, again, they're not extremely familiar with at the detailed level. Their decisions are tough, and when they have to make really tough decisions, when Sarah might be a crackerjack router engineer, ultimately they have to make the decision on whether or not they outsource Sarah no matter how good her job is. That's not a position I personally want to be in ever again, and I've had to help executives make that decision, and it's not fun.
Is the C-suite something to aspire to? And if it is, how would I actually go about doing that?
So it is something to aspire to if you don't love technology. I need to, I think, give a cautionary tale on my own career path. When I left Lockheed Martin and I left that detail architecture role, I think for the last time in my career, I'll look back on that and lament the times where I could take a blank server, install vSphere, networking, and everything else, and put it into production. And when the stuff hit the fan and you had to get the network engineer, the server administrator, the performance management folks, the CM guys all on the phone, and you led that call and you did that and you solved that problem or you led the solving of the problem, if that gets your juices flowing and you can't imagine not doing that again, then forget the C-suite because you'll solve interesting problems, but it won't be those problems anymore. If you love technology, C-suite probably isn't for you. Now, if you want a different challenge, and you're like, you know what? If I never saw another CLI again, I'd be happy. Then you need to go on a course of educating yourself. You look at it, it's like, similar to taking the CCIE, but a different path is I need to acquire the skill and knowledge needed. You can take my path and you can go work for a management consulting company like Deloitte & Touche, PwC, Ernst & Young, even IBM or Accenture. And you can kind of go through a few years of learning the business behind IT and learning IT and then re-entering the traditional enterprise. Or you can simply go to school and get an MBA. And depending on your educational background, two of those paths might be preferable to you.
Do I have to have an undergrad degree to get into an MBA program?
You have to have an undergrad degree to get into an MBA program. So if like me, so, you know, I'm going to be brutally honest. I was in school from 2003 until 2012 to get both my undergrad and master's program. That was 9 years.
Big commitment, not only of time, but money, too.
I'm $100,000 in debt. Don't mind sharing that. U.S. government knows, so you can know, too. And for me personally, it was worth it. I was at an age that it made sense. My salary, my resulting salary and compensation has matched. So for me, it was a fine decision. That's not for everybody.
Okay. So, yeah, you can aspire to it. And education is going to be a big key to doing that. And it's interesting what you say about you got to be ready to step away from the technology. You know, I've been a manager of, you know, lower level manager, typically more like a technical team lead role, even though my title was manager. And the management, I always thought being in charge was like the thing, you know, if you know all the technology, you should be the guy in charge that can just make all the decisions. It's just not like that. It's not really how the world works. And it took years of me being a manager in different roles to understand it's not really what I want. Not really what I'm co-founder of my own company now, so it's a different. I'm saying this a little tongue in cheek, I suppose. But at that time, anyway, enjoyed the technology so much that that is really what I wanted to do. And trying to move up the ladder was not what I wanted to do, even though it was a path for more responsibility and more money.
So, Ethan, I was talking to an engineer, or actually an architect, the other day, and he kept calling converged hyperconverged. And this is the guy that does the nuts and bolts. While he was getting the label wrong, he more or less knew what he was talking about. And I so wanted to just step in and correct him and say, but I'm the CTO advisor. I'm not the architect. And it's tough. The other day, someone gave me administrator rights to a lab server. And I got really excited. I'm like, all right, I'll add users. And an engineer came up to me and said, that's okay, Keith. We'll do it. And at that moment, again, I was reminded, yeah, those days are behind me. And I was a little disappointed.
Well, Keith, I know you're socially active. How can people follow you, contact you, read your blog, etc.?
Easiest way to find me is on Twitter. I'm at CTO Advisor on Twitter. Then the podcast and the blog can be found at thectoadvisor.com. And that's CTO Advisor spelled the UK way, S-O-R.
Okay, CTOADVISOR, CTO Advisor. Okay, very good. And that is it for today's edition of the Data Knots podcast. You can reach me at EC Banks on Twitter. My blog is ethancbanks.com. And Chris was out this week, but you can reach him at Chris Wall on Twitter, and his blog is wallnetwork.com. And for more of our Data Knots shows about infrastructure engineering, nosedive down the rabbit hole that is packetpushers.net. You'll find the Data Knots talking about containers and conferences, certifications, PowerShell, moving to cloud, full stack engineering, storage architecture, and so much more. And until then, may your server lights blink, your storage spindles spin, and your cables be cleanly managed.